Welcome to our latest episode of Fed Ninjas, and we couldn't be happier to have our next guest, Merit Bear. Many of you have probably heard about her work. Merit serves as an advisor to a number of young companies, and she advises executives on cloud security and go-to-market from Fortune 100 banks to biotech startups. She has also served as a lead cyber advisor to the Federal Communications Commission, as well as served at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Office of the U.S. Senator Michael Bennet, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Many of her insights are on business strategy and tech. She has been published in Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, and a whole lot more. I could go on and on, but Merit, thank you for making the time for us today.
Thank you. Yeah, happy to be here. I'm coming to you from my, among others, happy to chat about whatever comes up. And for folks who would like to follow up, you can find me on Twitter at Merit Bear.
Perfect. And I will definitely add that to our
show notes.
Yes, the show notes.
I always like when people understand that we're just real people who are working on this.
Hey, we're real people. What?
Your avatar is really not very good today, Eric.
We'll just jump right into it. I know that you've done a lot of work across the board. When I look at the things that you've dealt with, especially with the evolving role of a CISO and helping people communicate what that is and the importance, especially at the C-suite levels, you've done a lot of great communications.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I spent about 5.5 years as deputy CISO at AWS, and since then have gone into young companies world. So I advise a small handful of seed through Series B companies. And I think vantage points are different. I came to AWS from US government, worked in all three branches doing security. And we were just briefly chatting before this about how vocabularies matter. Mm. I think that when we're thinking about, for example, US government work, a lot of what is relevant when you're doing what feels like similar issues like supply chain considerations, or one of the last things, for example, that I did before I left US government was I was at the FCC and I put in undersea cable. I wrote the FCC put in undersea cable outage reporting requirements, because until that point, we didn't know if it was just the Thai fishermen dragging anchor or the Russians cutting it. There are ways in which the lanes of the road. I always get annoyed when folks say, we don't know where the lanes of the road are. We do. Right. Law enforcement is trying to catch the bad guy, and they're trying to get things that stand up in court. So that's FBI and Secret Service and the other law enforcement agencies like NCIS and other folks that have jurisdiction in a courtroom and for whom a win is getting folks in an indictment. We know that regulators are looking for things that are classically under monetized from a regulation standpoint. You're talking about things that the market doesn't correct for on its own. So this could be IoT security, and I tried to work on that. This could be collaborations between entities and other kinds of things. And then the hard part about security work is that the vast majority of the internet is privately owned and operated. A lot of what I was doing at DHS was just like common sense stuff. Sure, I worked to have us literally move the .gov from HTTP to HTTPS, not kidding, which feels late for 2015 or whenever this was, but it still hadn't happened. But at the same time, mostly civilians are conveners in government. And so you look at the ISACs and the ways that they can have impacts, but we're looking at even regulatory overlaps there, where like PCI was a payment card industry choosing to come together to come up with some standards. I think there are lanes of the road where folks are really trying to do the right thing where they are, but those are not always evident, especially for folks who don't have a lot of experience in these areas of work. And when you see an issue out there and you're like, we should be doing something about this, the real answer is, yeah, but we're a rules-based society, unlike some of our folks who we have to go up against. For example, if we make treaties, we're one of the few folks who keep them or who have lawyers who are helping us interpret them in ways that are not just beneficial to our country, but are preserving the rule of law overall. There's a lot of ways in which I think because of the nature of security being something that's both technical, diplomatic, regulatory, and all these other things, we have to think about where those motives come from. How can we think about wins coming out?
That's powerful stuff. I didn't even think about We'd probably only be the only country that would honor those treaties. You just look at it in light of that. That's a lot of not ethical issues, but blurry lines per se that you're working with. And just coming from your background as a JD, I'm sure you see things that people are throwing out there that they're trying to get around that. But anyway, I'm talking in circles right now. I want to get over to Eric over here.
Yeah, totally. So, Merritt, this is really good perspective. And I'm thinking for younger cybersecurity people, like, where do I want to go with my career? What do I want to do? And I'm thinking you should do what Merritt did because she has experience. She has a JD, so she has a law degree. And also, she's worked with government and she's worked with private sector and with younger companies. And so that gives you that observation, like she was talking about. So, my question to Merritt is, what do you think that public sector can do? I know you mentioned moving to TPS, HTTPS, hard word to say.
Yes, please do that if you haven't already. Let's start there.
So some of the things that have taken a while and understanding how they have worked typically in enclave environments and different things like that, so they have different expectations. But also what each other could take from others' experience, private sector to public sector, to increase their security capabilities. I know if there was a lot of information sharing, or I guess just observations from people's experience in leading programs like you have, being able to see both sides, what could one benefit from the other back and forth?
There's a lot of benefits, and there's also a lot of weight that one brings to the other. Like when we were in government trying to solve hard problems, we'd be like, what does Goldman Sachs do around this? And part of that will be technical. And in the case of AWS or Goldman or some of the sophisticated firms, they're building their own stuff in-house, but they're also vending themselves stuff from the ecosystem. So they're looking at some of the same problems that government is. At the same time, government has a unique mission statement. They're not there to maximize shareholder value. They are there. I think part of it is for folks who are looking at roles, I think you alluded to the fact that there might be folks listening now who are thinking about what they want to do and if they want to work in this space, where to start. There's no gilded path here. There's no yellow brick road, which is the best and worst thing about it. There's not a reason that you can't go from being a first grade teacher to working in security at the same time, or and I use that as a specific one because I actually think it has a lot of carryover, but or an architect or an artist. But there is also nothing to say that you can't take lawyer or other expertise. I did go to law school, but I am not anyone's lawyer, and I have not acted as anyone's lawyer, and I like having lawyers who can give me the lawyer answer, and I can know what the law says. But I think good lawyers give you opinions about what course they might take without being overly prescriptive unless the law requires it. So if there's a bright line rule that says Eric has to show up on Tuesdays in Minnesota, then you have to show up on Tuesdays in Minnesota. So you have to file your taxes. Except when you file an extension or someone's filing part of it for you. You know what I mean? There's always stuff that feels like ways that you need to understand the nuance of the law too. And I'm seeing CISOs have a profile that is whatever field they came from, it's taking advantage of that. And frequently I do see lawyers coming from there or like CISOs coming from the law. But yeah, I think folks who have varied backgrounds make for better security engineers and analysts and operators and compliance folks and whatever, fill in the blank in this field. And I also think that it is a little bit like the military where you have to figure out how to translate your skills over instead of just your title.
Yeah, good point. Nice.
Those are excellent points. Being an adjunct professor at a couple of universities, what are some of the things that the students have been asking, or what did they ask? I know it's been a couple of years now, but what were some of the things that you found interesting that they were asking? And if you've kept in contact with any of them, what are some of the things that they're seeing, and how did they connect all the dots from what they learned as a student and what they're doing as a professional now?
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, one of my former students from UMUC recruited me into Amazon.
Oh,
So
that's
I got a
great.
note on LinkedIn saying, I don't suppose you'd want to come work for AWS. And I said, I'm a business person. Like, I would listen. Yeah, shout out to Kevin. And he was like a mid-career guy living in Amsterdam using his GI Bill. So yeah, it's pretty awesome. I do think that this is a good jumping off point actually to say, obviously you need to be courteous and professional to your professors, but also remember that's your first or one of your first opportunities to network with folks who are in the field, offering to do some research. What if you wrote a paper together? I have another student who we drafted a series of articles around data breach, Chinning Sharma, and now she's teaching at, I think she's at UT Austin. But there's a lot of ways in which folks who you will encounter who are practitioners or professors in the field could be folks who end up turning into advocates for yourself professionally and personally. When you're a student, you feel like you're ages behind, but your professors did this too. Everyone had to do it at some point where they figure out who's interesting and smart and how their interests might intersect with something you care about that you want to work on. The security space is, I think, so personal. This isn't just, oh, let me make sure that I understand how FedRAMP works. It might be like, I'm from a Native community and I want to start a company that can do business with the government. Now I need to navigate that space. This is a person who could help me understand how that operates. Or I care about the fact that security impacts different communities differently. What does that look like in practice? I've written about child sexual abuse material and about other issues that are personal, but also those have ricochets around how well we are encrypting, how well we are allowing companies to do reporting or to obligate them to do reporting so that they can pay attention or not, so that it's in the ecosystem for journalists to also have cover when they're working in dangerous areas. There's a lot of ways in which these are very personal issues. And I think we shouldn't forget that, like, when folks are banking online and they're dating online and they're storing their money or their whatever matters to you is usually happening with some touch point in something that relates to security in the InfoSec sense. It also involves you as a human. And those are issues that if you get fired up about that, you should go work on.
Thank you for humanizing that, because so oftentimes when you look at a CISO, anything with cybersecurity, it can seem so impersonal. And to see that connection between student legacy, cooperation, everything, that made a heartstring type of thing for me. So thank you.
That's a good transition.
Yeah,
too, Maurice.
I hope so.
That's a really good transition into the next question that I have for sure. And that is, you're a very business focused person. You're the most dangerous person in the room because business, and you have a law degree, and yes, you're a cybersecurity expert, and you've worked with government and private sector. Here is my loaded question. And this is something I just saw very recently, is how do you get business people, the C-level suite, to take the CISO and cybersecurity seriously, especially when you have a CISO maybe that's had experience, wants to show risk-based, wants to work at a business level?
I would say 100% of CEOs will say they care about security, but so what? The answer is, until I think, is until they're willing to say no to other business imperatives because security has to come, they haven't actually put their money where their mouth is, literally. But I think it's the CISO's job, or CSO. Increasingly, I'm seeing the role move from CISO to CSO, where they're responsible for fraud and bad behavior and physical security too. I saw that move during COVID because folks were seeing a lot of those behaviors and no one at the executive level owned it. But I think that it's that set of folks' job to make this a business problem. What EDEs that you fix this week? That doesn't mean anything to a CEO. What you need to do is, like, it's still good to quantify, but you also need to contextualize, like, why this matters, which CVEs matter to your environment more than others. And not just, here's my CVE report, but we've been, and having regular reporting here is healthy and helpful, but having someone understand the level of risk they were at the last time that you spoke, and then where you're at now, how that translates to business outcomes. And a lot of times, I think personally, that CISOs undervalue availability as one of the pillars. Remember that the CIA triad is confidentiality, integrity, availability.
Yes.
I'm so sick of hearing zero trust. Actually, I'm like, you have to have some trust. Otherwise, you can't do any, like, right, this coffee cup is zero trust. Nothing comes in or out. It also doesn't do anything.
Right.
We're not, it's not doing business. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. Just unhook everything.
So availability, or close it all down. No, we're going to have first of all, we're going to have business happening. We're going to have some trust here. And I mean that in the lowercase t, but also, I guess, in the uppercase t. And by that, TLS handshakes. But we could also have trust in the sense that we're going to do business with other companies. We might frame that in ways that we feel like we've hedged some of that risk, but we're still going to do it. We're going to have internet-facing endpoints, but we can put security around what we see when traffic comes in and out. We need to have stuff happening. And increasingly, especially with cloud, availability is something that you actually buy down or buy up, but it's a risk you buy down. So like, how much are you willing to tolerate? And that's true in a lot of ways. Not that it's a one-to-one dollars for security or for outcomes, because I do think that you can make intelligent choices around how you spend and how you, or I should say, invest. But I do think that keeping in mind business outcomes are part of the security that you're paying for, and locking everything down is not the solution. That has to be part of the kind of what I think of as like the current CISO when they go into the approach, which is, we're not going to lock it down, but just so you know, if we tolerate this amount of downtime, this is what it's going to cost us. Or if we tolerate this amount of unauthorized traffic, some of which might be our customers trying to legitimately log in from Topeka when they've never been there before, or from China when they've never been there before, we're going to have to frame it in terms of the risk that we're paying for in that context. And you can buy it down a little bit, and then you also make the business accept or make them aware of what they're accepting.
That makes sense. You're putting it into quantifying it into business risk, which most of the C-level folks will understand. And in my experience, the CEO is very involved in that with risk, and they really listen to the cybersecurity leader. Sometimes you get other people in the C-suite and they just, yeah, we don't want to listen to this guy. And like you said, availability, that's counter to the folks who are responsible for keeping the systems available. But when you quantify these all into risk-based, I think that's, I love your answer on that, by the way, that was great. Mm-hmm. A small follow-up to that too. So RSA conference is this week as we're recording this. And there's some interesting things. I'd like to hear your take on what you've heard out of RSA. But also one person posted, I think on least on LinkedIn, that said some CISOs are down because they feel like they're not being heard or they're not being taken seriously still. And so there's kind of those rumblings. But yet I do see a lot of very positive things from other stories from RSA. So I guess what are the takes that you've got from RSA?
I feel like I get CISOs all the time coming up being like, I just don't have enough budget and I don't get enough. And I'm like, oh yeah, there's a support group for that. It's called Everyone. And they meet at the bar or the gym or their kids park on a Saturday morning. Yeah. But I guess the point is, so what? First of all, you need to be framing it in business terms that folks can understand. Second of all, you need to be doing everything you can to really get your networking and other decision-making up to speed. I do recommend that folks take a hard look at the vendors they're paying for. You can use some tooling even to do that. One company I advise, Level 6, does that where they'll give you ROI. But you also should just be doing regular vendor reviews in regardless, in my view. What I'm seeing at RSA, and I guess I say that in part because I think the tech can help you. It's not going to save you, but it can help you to prioritize and to understand what you're getting when you are using this. And especially, I frankly think, not to say that on-prem security isn't also a business calculation, but I think especially with cloud, what we're talking about is sort of rationalization here. So you're abstracting above, you're doing a lot of stuff that computers do better than humans. 20 years ago, it was like, let's go check and make sure these VMs are plugged in. And it was like some guy's job to go do that. And he may have worked in security. Now that's not what we're doing, right? We're articulating networks. We're constantly, even pen tests, I think, are important, but you, in sophisticated shops, you can be constantly getting an articulation of your risk, including descriptions of your networking or other, or your IAM permissioning in things like analyzers. So I think there has been a lot of development in terms of how to approach that from a tech stack perspective. I am seeing the whizzes of the world are not going anywhere, but I think that CSPM and some of these other management tools, whatever, Palo Alto's and whizzes aren't going anywhere, but I'm seeing SaaS security be super top of mind just because I think especially with AI engines, making it so queryable in natural language for your employees to get into whatever, and it could be your employees or it could be other folks, because we know that attackers come through the front door too, that folks can query in ways that they didn't. If you haven't permissioned not just your own environment, but all as part of your own environment, all the apps within that. So like Salesforce and a bunch of other really broad apps that have hooks almost everywhere, you're now going to have your Copilot being able to, your employees can query it in ways that you probably didn't anticipate, let alone your developers writing code that might be biased, poisoned, et cetera. There's just ways that I think SaaS security is top of mind. Now, I do advise a company, Ricoh, that works in this space because I think it's so important, edge computing. And I think in part because while we see compute getting ever more powerful, there are also tech elements of edge that matter a lot, both for how folks are accessing, like you should be caching at the edge and taking advantage of it, but also it alleviates some of the pain of chip shortages and other things that we're seeing. At this point, if you are using raw EC2, which is like Amazon's basic unit of compute, you should really be asking yourself why, because you should be taking advantage of abstracted and forms of this. And again, one of the reasons I know more about this is through a company that I advise called Expanso, that's based on an open source protocol called Bacalao. And you can do compute and storage at the edge. And it's just so much more efficient. It's more sustainable, has better cost outcomes. I think the bread and butter stuff is not going anywhere. We're going to have posture management and backup storage, especially because ransomware isn't going anywhere. It's still going to be, it's democratized more than ever. You don't even have to be good, as we all know. But if you look at the recent string of attacks in the real world, whether it's the casinos or SolarWinds or any of the other ones, they're coming in what feels like the front door. And that's through your apps, your vendors, you could be rolling your own K8s in a perfect way, and they're still walking in the front door. So it's really this compartmentalized security. And then I think just from a tech perspective, I think we're going to see edge computing to really blossom.
You've been in some pretty established companies, and now you're advising a lot of these young companies. What I'd love to know is, what could an established company learn from the young, and vice versa?
Young companies are generally trying to be responsive to established companies. And this is actually usually where I get involved in an advisory sense, is that they've built something that they believe works, that is a product that's responsive to the enterprise space, or in the case of a company I advise called Andesite that's trying to reduce manual load for analysts, they're trying to be responsive to both government.gov and .mil, and also to private sector space on these pain points. They're a young company. The answer is, the young companies are looking to establish companies for pain points. But of course, I essentially am working with the young companies on understanding what the parameters are, and I don't mean that in a code base, but although it could be, on how they can interact with or can consume this capability in a way that's consistent with their procurement cycles, with what they're doing today around this pain point, and whether they're doing it themselves or they're paying someone who's not doing it that well or whatever. So I think that like the best and worst thing about young companies is that they are driven by following others' problems. They care about solving for the stuff that others are doing and how to get enterprises more efficient. Yeah. Of course, the hard part with that empathy is that young companies, so for example, Ricoh, who I mentioned, they have an SLA of 3 days. They will get your SaaS app. If they don't currently cover it, they'll just get it covered. I've never seen that in any large company. They would never put an SLA around that because it's like bold and risky but I think it's actually like one of the reasons that it's fun to work in young companies is that they're pushing really hard to deliver. And there's a lot of nights and weekends, and there's a lot of that big companies can't afford to ask people to do. But there's also a lot of not asking for permission. If you think it's the right thing to do, you go do it. So I think they each are constantly learning from each other. And I think maybe large companies don't realize that young companies, there's a lot of deserved flack for sales folks, but I think mostly young companies, at least in my view, the ones I work with, we're trying to solve genuine problems that folks are not actually good at today, or are not aware that they need to solve for. And so those get better when you have this kind of team that's in theory augmenting what you're doing without realizing that you're not very good at it. That's the idea, is that they're not coming in to sell you. They're coming in to help you fix this.
Nice. Very good. That's a reason to build something as a small company and then hope for merger acquisition, right? That's the goal for everyone.
I think as a young company, you want to solve something that you feel like is small enough to bite off, but representative enough that you can get really big.
Sure.
And the goal is never, well, at least I do have a reality TV idea, which is where you just make up a deck and see if someone will buy it without you ever having to even build your company. Just see if Paolo will buy it anyway.
The vaporware.
That's just Merit being irreverent. But no, I think the goal for any devoted founder is to stay, to have it be. And remember that Mark Zuckerberg had plenty of offers for $1 million when we were there. I was his same year in undergrad. And we were like, you're crazy. Just sell it. $1 million.
And then when Zuckerberg in Harvard?
Yeah, I was put on Hot or Not without my consent, which is one
reason
I got it.
Holy cow. So you were one of his test subjects.
Awesome.
Oh my gosh.
Is
wow.
It?
I think he owes you some money.
I think, yeah.
That's awesome.
No idea.
Okay, just going back a little bit. That's something really good that you pointed out too, is like when you build something, you're trying to solve for a business problem, then you're invested in it and it's your baby. You don't really want to sell it. You want to see it be successful and follow it through. So like mergers and acquisitions, yeah, they're great. It's good to be able to build something really good that a larger company can then buy, and then hopefully they don't screw it up too bad. But I think that's why a lot of people don't want to sell, is they want to make sure that it's working correctly as they visioned it.
In practice, we're all business people. And if someone came along and said, I want to buy your house, you're going to say no initially. And then if they're like quoting a number that you wouldn't contemplate, you're like, all right, let's talk about this. But I think folks who build a company planning to sell it off build crappier companies. So I think
build
it assuming that it is your house that you're going to live in. I like to use the house metaphor, not the baby, because I'm not selling my baby. I don't care how much.
Good point.
She's not for sale. Happy Mother's Day, everyone. there is a difference. It's something that you built, that you care deeply about, that you've invested a lot of hours, including bedtimes you missed with your family. But it's still your house. You can build another or buy another. And people are open to that. But I don't think that we've all been in houses that people built just to flip. And it feels flimsy. Because it is. They were never planning to live there. It's true for ransomware protection and for other kind of security issues too, which is build your house right. Being like, I have a shed out back. That's not a good backup plan. You don't want them in your house. Or I bolted the windows twice. What if they walk in the front door? That's not a plan. So I think, I use house analogies in part because I think it just reflects, it is intimate. And it is a place that you spend a lot of kind of human hours, but also it feels invasive when folks come in unauthorized. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you can find ways that protect it better. You can obviously put up cameras and watch them rob you, but hopefully they don't come in.
It's good to use analogies because a lot of times people are like, I don't want to hear that cybersecurity crap. Analogies can resonate with the people that hopefully are listening to you. So that's good.
Yeah, they all break down at some point. But I think the point is building it right is both a commitment to doing the right thing over time and to knowing that if you build workarounds, people will treat them as workarounds.
There's so many other questions. I want to be cognizant of our time. Would you consider coming back and talking with us?
Yeah, of course. No, I'm happy to come back and always happy to have a conversation. I do feel like there's a little bit of some of it deliberate and some of it not opaqueness in the industry. Just there's so many acronyms and there's a lot of hand waves around what either people are doing or what the tech is capable of or other things. And so one of the things that I have found is just being, I appreciate folks who want to just ask questions or answer questions or just stop acting like they know it all and acknowledge that we all work hard at this. We get better over time.
Very good. Good advice.
That is fantastic advice.
Oh, good. It's been fun talking to you all and really appreciate it and glad that you're democratizing information. That's more is more.